Welcome back to another episode of City Hall Pass. I'm Kapel Lungani, counsel to the mayor of New York City. We created this forum, the first of its kind in New York City, to give you, the public, a unique window into the highest levels of our city government. We interview New York City's finest public servants and get them to open up in a way that is both deeply personal and insightful. And on its best days, we hope that our podcast is equal parts educational and inspiring. And now I want to introduce my two co-hosts today, two brilliant women who inspire me every day, Bess Chu and Kate Coughlin.
Thanks, Kapel. Happy to be here. This is Bess Chu. I'm currently Chief of Staff to the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor.
Hi, I'm Kate Coughlin, and I currently serve as Deputy Counsel for the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor.
I'm excited to introduce our guest for this episode, President and CEO of the nonprofit Partnership for New York City, Kathy Wild. Kathy heads the partnership, which is the city's leading business organization. Its mission is to work with government, labor, and the civic sector to build a stronger New York with a focus on education, infrastructure, and the economy. Wild is an internationally known expert in housing, economic development, and urban policy. Prior to taking over the partnership presidency in 2001, Wild was the founding CEO of both the partnership's housing and investment fund affiliates. From 1982 to 2000, she was responsible for developing and managing affordable housing and economic development programs that contributed to the renaissance of urban neighborhoods across the five boroughs. We spoke to Kathy about her historic career, her commitment to building and supporting stronger neighborhoods in our city, some of the partnership's priorities, her vision for the future of New York City, and much more. We hope you enjoy.
It gives me great pleasure to welcome the president and CEO of the nonprofit Partnership for New York City, Kathy Wild, to City Hall Pass. Kathy, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us today.
Happy to be with you.
Obviously, we know how committed you are to your community. You actually were an organizer in Sunset Park. And I've read about how the, for lack of a better term, the destruction of Sunset Park, the neighborhood itself, had an influence on you. How did it influence your decision to focus on community development?
I went to work at the end of the 60s, and that was the end of the manufacturing era, really for the United States, but also for New York. People don't realize now that through the 1960s, New York was a manufacturing town. The hospital where I went to work with, Lutheran Medical Center, was in Sunset Park on the waterfront, and we were one of those communities that saw the economy devastated as companies moved out of Bush Terminal, out of Southwest Brooklyn, out of Red Hook. We lost Bethlehem Steel, American Machine and Foundry, American Can, Revere Sugar, et cetera, et cetera. Just all those jobs left. The longshoreman industry, and a lot of longshoremen lived at Sunset Park at the time, that was gone. They moved to Jersey to the new container ports developed. And so it really wiped out. We lost a million people in New York City. We lost half our Fortune 500 companies in a matter of 5 years. That neighborhood and the whole Brooklyn waterfront and all the neighborhoods that abutted it really disintegrated in before our eyes in no time at all. And the question was, what do we do? How do we hang on? So communities developed a sense of self-determination throughout the city. And the whole community development movement came out of that. And so all the community development corporations that exist around the city, they really started at that time. Bedford-Stuyvesant Restoration Corporation was the first. Los Orris in Williamsburg, then St. Nick's, Sunset Park Redevelopment. I know the Brooklyn folks well, but it happened across the city, across the five boroughs. And communities really stepped forward in constructive ways. And I compare it to today. We don't have that same support for the community infrastructure. At the time, we were getting federal funding for community-based activities, and we just don't have that. This is the Jimmy Carter era. We don't have that same sources of support for community development today, and I think it's something very important to resurrect, because so often communities are represented by advocates or adversaries. They're not at the table as professionals. And during at the height of the community development movement, the community could sit there and say, we will develop housing. We will partner with the private sector, and we know how to fill out bank loan applications for affordable housing, low income housing. And so there was a whole different professionalism within our communities that today has kind of gravitated to human services, workforce development, other areas where there are funding streams, healthcare in some cases. But in terms of development activity, there are very few organizations left that are strong development entities. And I think that's something we really have to work on. I'm hoping that the city will and the state will start to really invest in reinvigorating community development. Because if people are at the table, as we were in the 70s, if the community is at the table helping to plan the development of its future, all of a sudden they're pro-growth and pro-housing development, as opposed to what we've seen in recent years where they've become fear of gentrification, anti-development. So I think that's very important. And that's a lesson that I bring from my personal experience, and I hope to share with the younger generations who are now thinking about what are we going to do going forward.
It's interesting. You know, we, in our job, one of the primary roles we've played, particularly over the last couple of years, has been consensus building. Right. We have these extraordinarily complex issues and innumerable stakeholders, from the private sector to labor to the government itself. And I think your point about consensus building and being a problem solver and getting people to the table and actually ending up with a solution, rather than, you know, it's not enough to just bring people in for a meeting. There's a skill in getting people to an end result. And I think, you know, you're well known for that, Kathy. I think it is a rare thing, frankly, when, you know, sitting here in government, the people that are good at that rise, because there are not many people who can understand the diverse array of interests and find the common area. In fact, we were talking to Henry Garrido, who said, you know, part of his approach to negotiation is find the 80% that you agree on. And in doing that, you're going to establish trust amongst all the stakeholders. And that allows you to bridge the gap on the last 20%.
Yes, I think that's right. It's also important to know where you're not going to be able to agree or get consensus, and just to take that off the table. So you don't have unnecessary tension, or you don't give people an excuse to walk out of the room. So I think it's both sides of the story.
And what impressed you so much about New York City that you never left?
It was the diversity of New York City that impressed me. And we all say that today, but honestly, I remember getting here and calling up my dad and saying, "Dad, I've met Puerto Ricans, I've met Italians, I've met great food of all ethnic types." And my father said, "Kathy, you grew up with Puerto Ricans and Italians. They just didn't self-identify." So Madison, Wisconsin, I call it the homogenized state. You know, everybody was the same. We had to look up. In the eighth grade, we looked up what we were ethnically, because we did not know. The great divide actually was on a religious basis. I was Lutheran. Kids that were in parochial schools were, I mean, that was the divide in Wisconsin. So there wasn't this ethnic identity, at least in Madison. Milwaukee's a different story. But I grew up in a very homogenized place, and I just loved the diversity of New York, that it's like you were traveling the world just hanging out in your neighborhood.
Our office worked closely with Deputy Mayor Bean's team and her housing economic development team on plans to, you know, expand broadband and affordable housing, expand green space, business improvement districts. You are internationally known as an expert in housing, economic development, and urban policy. Why should New Yorkers care about these sorts of issues?
Well, New York is comprised of its neighborhoods, and the health of our neighborhoods depends on a mix of residential and commercial activity. And clearly, the housing agenda has been very important to this administration and has done a good job at making sure. I mean, the latest victory getting through the Gowanus rezoning is very important. The announcement that NYCHA is going to be able to do a couple thousand units in Chelsea and finally get that done last week. Congratulations to Greg Russ and to Speaker Cory Johnson and to the administration for pulling that off. We've had some real positive breakthroughs. But I do think that a home ownership component of the housing program, a robust home ownership component going forward, is very important to allay the anti-development fears. That when I first went to the South Bronx and I was working for David Rockefeller when I went to the partnership in 1982, and they were just as afraid of gentrification. And we got there and I said, you know, the fears were, oh, David Rockefeller and the banks are going to come to our neighborhoods and we're going to be forced out. And we went and we explained, no, we're going to have a home ownership program. You're going to have the first opportunity to buy these homes. You're going to have a stake in the future of your neighborhood. And all of a sudden it was, wow, David Rockefeller is going to invest in our neighborhood and we'll be part of it. And those homes that we sold, two family homes, 2,500 square feet, we sold in the 80s and early 90s for, I know in Soundview, $94,000 for a two family home with rental income. Today, those homes are worth $400,000, $500,000. Home ownership, I think, has to be part of the New York City housing agenda. And we still have twice as many tenants as we do owners. And that's very important. And reinforcing NYCHA and the public housing is very important. But I think the home ownership component of the redevelopment agenda is one that we should emphasize going forward.
Yeah, I actually think that's so interesting, your comment about homeowners having equity in their community. Because I actually think that sounds, from my experience, my parents are immigrants, and it sounds very similar to the immigrant experience of you wanting to own like a piece of the land, right? Like a piece of America. And so for that, in order to do that, really the, I guess, the kind of most direct way is home ownership. And like buying into your community, being part of your community. And it's really something that I grew up hearing a lot about in my family, because I come from an immigrant family and, you know, we grew up in an immigrant community, or I've spent a lot of time in the immigrant community. So that really speaks to me personally.
No, absolutely. And that was something I learned. I guess I grew up with that in the Midwest because everybody owned a home. That was the American dream. That was your financial security. And my dad borrowed, mortgaged his house to send me to college. So that was, wow. It's just the way I think.
Look, in our culture, it's the same thing. My parents would always say, look, it's the only thing that matters to us is education, right? Like they waited, they knew the day that my report card was coming. And they said, look, as long as you're in school, we will make sure that you can keep going to school. And so that what you just said sings to me.
The biggest numbers of home buyers of our partnership homes, and we produced over 40,000 homes over the course of 15 years throughout the neighborhoods of the five boroughs, from Stapleton and Staten Island to Springfield Gardens and Jamaica and Queens to the South Bronx and Harlem. Throughout that experience, it was just people resonated. It restored a middle class into those neighborhoods. Our number one home buyers were transit workers. And in terms of where they lived before, our number one people coming out of NYCHA. And it was the first, in every case, it was the first new home ownership opportunities, new housing built in these neighborhoods in more than 50 years. And it was, the churches were a lot of our sponsors of the housing because their constituencies during the previous decades had moved out of the city, their middle class families.
So as chief of staff to our team, I'm constantly mobilizing our team to get answers for the mayor, for senior policymakers within the city. As president and CEO of the partnership, the city's leading business organization, your organization is focused on mobilizing private sector resources and expertise to advance New York City's standing as a global center of economic opportunity, upward mobility, and innovation. How would you describe the work of the partnership?
Well, I think you just described it well, but to make it more specific, it's to try and find ways that the corporate community can aggregate their efforts to make an impact. New York is so big and so siloed that even a very generous corporate philanthropic program is a drop in the bucket if it's just one company. The game is, how do you get everybody on the same page? And of course, companies obviously want credit for what they do. They'd like their name at the top of the sign, et cetera, et cetera. So getting people to work together, you know, it takes some real consensus building on their part. An example of a program that we launched in February 2019, and we hope to resurrect soon, is we did a career discovery week where we had 210 companies major companies commit to take a class of 10th graders from our most disadvantaged schools, and we ended up with 6,000 10th graders, spent one day during the second week in February in 2019 at a corporate office building where they had programming, they got lunch, they got swag, they had an opportunity to meet people of color in particular who were senior executives in those companies. For many of these kids, it was their first time in a high-rise office building. And it was their first exposure. And it was thousands. It was 6,000 kids. And afterwards, we worked with the Department of Education on this, partnered with them on this. And afterwards, we did evaluations. And from the teachers who were the supervisors, from the kids, and from the employees of the companies, they loved the program.
What gives you confidence about New York City's ability to return and recover from the COVID-19 pandemic?
Well, the city has reinvented itself many times, and it is, as you say, the diversity. We've got a very broad base of interests and people who speak a couple hundred languages. And we're a destination for the world, whether it's in business or culture or university presence, et cetera. So, you know, nobody could reconstruct this in a couple of generations, what we have here. So I have total faith in the strength of New York and its institutions and the depth of its assets, very deep.
I think the way government and business really came together during that time was unprecedented. How did you approach building those relationships? Because you were really integral to that time.
Well, the first was advising and coordinating with business on the lockdown and how to function. And within a matter of 2 weeks, literally the whole financial industry, the technology industry, the media industry were able to go completely remote seamlessly. And that's what kept the economy going. The brick and mortar economy, as you know, shut down. And what kept the economy going was technology and the investment in that infrastructure that our global industries had made. And as a result, we didn't see tax rolls plummet. In the professional sector, we did not see any loss of jobs. And then our focus shifted after that initial piece was done and you had the security of knowing, okay, the economy, the financial system is okay. Then we shifted our attention to the brick and mortar economy, to the small business. And then we worked with EDC to set up a small business resource center with volunteer lawyers, accountants, grants, technology supporters to get them online, et cetera. So that was the second thing that we did with private sector support.
I want to thank the wonderful Kathy Wild. Kathy, as has been very clear by this interview, is a part of the DNA of New York City and somebody who cares very deeply about this city. And Kathy, on behalf of the city, you know, all of the people who benefit from your extraordinary work, thank you so much, not only for this interview, but for everything that you do on a daily basis to make the lives of New Yorkers better.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
I want to thank President and CEO of the Nonprofit Partnership for New York City, Kathy Wild, for joining us on City Hall Pass. We hope you enjoyed this conversation and look forward to talking to you soon on another episode of City Hall Pass.
This podcast is brought to you by the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor of New York City.